Well, as you've heard today on WKAR from NPR, the Michigan-born Tom Hayden has died. Interestingly, Tom Hayden appeared on WKAR back in 2012, speaking to our Melissa Benmark in June of that year. Hayden talked about the Port Huron statement and about the change he'd like to see in the rest of his life. Interestingly, he said, "I grew up in Royal Oak, and I kind of loved my drugstore and my local book stand, and I think that kind of small business, combined with public schools, public universities that we had, needs to be preserved against the onslaught of Wall Street hierarchies." This is all a quote. "It seems to be out of control, at least for now. It can't last, it won't last, but I hope I'm around to see some kind of change in that area." The words of Tom Hayden on WKAR back in 2012. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today for Current State. The campaign for sheriff in Eaton County has seen some twists and turns that nobody could have predicted. Sheriff Tom Reich is a Democrat running for re-election. His opponent is Republican Fred McPhail, who served as undersheriff in a previous administration. He retired 2 years ago after serving in the department for more than a quarter century. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on this race, which has in some ways been overwhelmed by issues both candidates are facing in their personal lives. You've talked with both Reich and McPhail, Scott. What are these personal matters?
Well, Mark, both of these men are in the midst of very unpleasant family problems. Sheriff Reich is going through a divorce, and at one point, his estranged wife sought a personal protection order against him, an order that was rejected by a judge. And McPhail's teenaged son is facing a sex-related criminal charge. Not exactly the atmosphere either would have wanted for a campaign season. Both Reich and McPhail came in for interviews, and both were candid about their personal struggles and those of their opponent. I also gave them both a chance to talk about the positive messages they're trying to communicate. Let's start with the sex charge being faced by McPhail's son. He says that when it comes up, he has to explain what his son did because news reports have been vague.
What he did, he videotaped on his phone sex between two of his friends, two minors. And he sent that to another boy's phone, and he shared it with other kids, and other kids saw it. So I wanted to make it clear that he did not have sex with anyone. He videotaped it and sent it, and I'm certainly not excusing his behavior by any means, but that's what happened. But the original newspaper report was very vague, and it left it open to interpretation. And some people interpreted it that these two boys held down some young girl and raped her, and that certainly was not the case. This was a consensual sex act, and the reason that they were charged is because they were both minors and could not consent to sex.
Sheriff Reich says he doesn't bring up the criminal charge being faced by his opponent's son.
That's a personal issue that Fred and his family have to deal with. It's not my business. I don't throw mud. It's something I feel bad for the McPhail family. However, I'm sure they're dealing with their own hard times, and it's not in my business to do that. I'm running a campaign. I take the high road on everything. I don't throw anything bad against Fred. I'm just trying to do my job and run a department.
What is Sheriff Reich saying about his divorce and the personal protection order request made by his estranged wife here, Scott?
Well, first, a reminder that the PPO was denied by a judge. He says the divorce hasn't been coming up on the campaign trail.
I feel sorry. Nobody wants a divorce. Nobody expects a divorce. I certainly didn't expect it. It's just unfortunate, but it does happen. And it's become that, yeah, it became ugly. And not on my cause. I did everything right. I've been doing law enforcement for 29 years now, and I know that if you go over that line, I'm not going to do that. I'm a very intelligent man. I'm not stupid, and things are good. I'm waiting for next month's date with a court to get this divorce finalized, and my life can move on.
Challenger Fred McPhail says the sheriff's divorce does come up, but with some confusion.
It is occasionally. Some people, when I go to the door, will say, "I have to ask you a question. What is this about your wife seeking a personal protection order?" And I just tell them simply, "That's the other candidate. That's not me." Just recently, one person said, do you have the personal protection order on you, or do you have the kid that's in trouble? So then I have to explain that situation.
Are you saying you don't bring up his divorce proceedings or the PPO?
That's right. I do not mention it.
Did you ask the candidates about the Devin Guilford case, Scott?
Yes, I did, Mark. A quick refresher. Guilford was the unarmed Mullican teenager shot to death by Sergeant Jonathan Frost during a traffic stop. The Guilford family has filed a civil suit against the department, while Sergeant Frost did not face criminal charges. I asked Fred McPhail about how much responsibility Sheriff Reich should bear in the case, and he points to what he considers to be a departmental atmosphere that led to an earlier traffic stop case involving Deputy Greg Brown and motorist Todd Brenneser.
The situation was that Deputy Brown made a traffic stop and became very irritated and agitated at some of the questions that Mr. Brenneser was posing to him. And he ended up yanking Mr. Brenneser out of the car, throwing him on the ground, committing a false arrest, and lodging him in the jail and submitting a false police report. What Deputy Brown didn't realize is Mr. Brenneser had recorded all this on his cell phone. And, of course, it's a felony to do what he did. And the sheriff allowed him to quietly resign and did not seek criminal charges on him. And Mr. Brown went to work for another police agency. And just this past spring had a federal excessive force lawsuit filed against him for a similar act with other citizens in the county where he's currently working. So I think this acceptance of this type of behavior from the officers by Sheriff Reich has allowed something like the Guilford case to happen.
For his part, Sheriff Reich says he couldn't simply fire Brown.
He was suspended until we conducted our investigation. And it's kind of ironic. The investigator of that case was Fred McPhail. The deputies and command have labor contracts. And we also have department policy. And we have a regime of different types of policies that we have to go through when a deputy does something similar to this or other violations of the policy. We took that information to the prosecutor's office. Being that Greg Brown was a veteran, there's something that's called out there, and McPhail is very well aware of it. It's called veteran's preference. That gives that extra step for a veteran to have a hearing. So if we failed to do that, we would be liable. We'd have been sued. He'd have got his job back, and the county would have had to pay out money. Would we have terminated him after the veteran's preference? Absolutely. Did we take the high road at this and do everything properly? Yes, we did.
As for the Guilford case, Sheriff Wright calls it an unfortunate tragedy, but says that he followed policy in not terminating Sergeant Frost after the shooting.
We can all sit back and do a Monday morning quarterback on what should have done, what could have done, what should have been different. But being in law enforcement, when you have to make decisions, split-second decisions, becomes very important. Would I have done the same thing? Yes, if I was in that situation where I was losing unconsciousness, being plummeted in the head with fists constantly, I would have taken the same approach. Just recently in the Chicago Police Department, there was a 17-year-old veteran, female, that was beat severely by an individual who was on PCP, and she's in the hospital. And with that, they asked her, why didn't you shoot your firearm? She said she was scared because she was going to get all the scrutiny from the media. So that's pretty sad when law enforcement has to worry about if they're going to discharge your firearm or not, on a situation where it means life or death. And in this case, she did live, but still, it's still at point that they're thinking about what the media is going to do.
One more subject Fred McPhail raises is what he considers to be the militarization of the department by Sheriff Reich.
The current sheriff has accumulated a number of military vehicles and weapons and so forth that I don't think is necessary for our rural community.
Are you saying you'd sell those vehicles?
I'm not sure what I can legally do with them, whether it would be sell or return them to the federal government. I'd have to look at the contracts that he signed. But those types of vehicles and equipment are already in Eaton County because the state police has their headquarters in Eaton County, and they have a lot of sophisticated equipment and vehicles, and those are readily available, providing you have a good working relationship with the state police, which I think our department does. It always has, and I don't think that Sheriff Reich has diminished that in any way.
Sheriff Reich rebuffs the idea that he has militarized the department.
One of them is a military vehicle. It's our rescue vehicle, which protects not only our deputies when they go into an active shooter situation, but it also can save lives when we have to rescue a civilian. The old vehicle that we had, it was an old Brinks vehicle, and it was rusted, mechanical problems. We were continually putting money into it. And besides, the ammunition that's out there on the streets today would have tore a hole right through that vehicle. We've also received a Humvee. We received a Ford pickup truck from the military, civilian pickup truck, a civilian Chevy Tahoe. We received a boat from the military we use for our rescue, recovery, as well as our Marine Division. I've also received first aid kits from the military. I've also received blankets for the jail, shoes for inmates in the jail, computers and printers. So militarization, I wouldn't call it that.
Scott, what are some of the positives that these candidates are promoting in their campaigns?
Well, Mark, Fred McPhail touts his lengthy resume of 26 years with the department in nearly every job there is, including acting sheriff for a few months while former Sheriff Mike Raines was on medical leave. He'd like to restore the presence of deputies in schools, which has been reduced in recent years due to budget cuts. And he'd like to change the culture of the department to protect and serve.
Right now, the people in the community who I talk to, and I've been talking to folks since March, they feel that there's an us versus them mentality within the department, and I certainly want to change that. There's a lot of pressure on the deputies right now from the administration to write a lot of tickets and make a lot of arrests, and I've never been a proponent of that type of policing. I know at least when Sheriff Raines was sheriff and I was under sheriff, there was a lot of pressure from one of the judges to increase revenue for the courts. And the sheriff at that time was emphatic and told him he was not a revenuer for the county. I don't know if the current sheriff is under that type of pressure or not. I suspect that he is. I suspect that's what's driving a lot of the overly aggressive policing that has occurred under this sheriff.
So if you encountered similar pressure, you'd resist it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sheriff Reich points to a reduction in crime under his leadership, leading the way on issuing body cameras to deputies and carrying defibrillators in cars. He also has Narcan in patrol vehicles to save lives when heroin overdoses are encountered. He also says regional cooperation has improved.
From day one, we've reestablished our working relationships with the Michigan State Police. We work side by side. It's blue and brown out there on the streets. We've also reestablished a working relationship with other law enforcement agencies in Eaton County and also regionally. We work closely with Ingham County Sheriff's Office, Lansing Police Department. Working with the Lansing Police Department, we have something called the Capillary Violent Crime Initiative. We work closely with the FBI and Lansing Police Department on arresting serious felons that are out there on warrants. We have taken numerous handguns off the street. We've had a methamphetamine, we call it a meth team. We've had that prior to my coming into service. However, we've made it more of a regional type thing. We've got the Charlotte Police Department involved in it. We got the Grand Ledge Police Department involved in it and the Eaton Rapids Police Department. So when we go out and do our meth sweeps, all these departments are involved. It's not just the Eaton County Sheriff's Office. So it's nice to have the cooperation and collaboration from all these area police departments, and we've established that since day one.
So you can see, Mark, that voters in Eaton County have a lot to think about before casting their ballots for sheriff on November 8th.
It sounds like it, Scott. Thank you for the report.
You're welcome.
And coming up on Current State, in the first ever report of its kind, Michigan State University recently detailed data involving campus sexual violence, harassment, and stalking, and resulting investigations. Two university officials involved in the effort to reduce sexual violence discuss. That's coming up on Current State. Well, you never know where you'll find a Spartan. Not long after graduating from MSU School of Journalism, Detroit native Jessica Lipowski moved to Amsterdam to work in the travel industry and fulfill a lifelong dream of living abroad. She's written a book called Flavors of Life about a diverse group of restaurant owners in Amsterdam, and she's coming back to MSU this week to speak to students about it. Jessica, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Where did you come up with the idea for Flavors of Life?
Well, back in 2012, I was sitting at a Mexican restaurant, and across the street was a Caribbean restaurant. And we looked at this place, my partner and I, and we said, what's the story behind this Caribbean restaurant? Who is the owner? Are they from the Caribbean? Do they love Caribbean food? What's the story? Well, you may or may not know, Amsterdam is home to 180 nationalities. And when you look at that diversity, you see how it impacts the food scene. With that in mind, I thought, let's tell the stories behind the restaurants. Normally, we only hear about the food, the quality of service, and the establishment. And what's often missing is the person who created that experience.
How many people do you profile in the book?
62 people.
62? From 40-some countries?
Yeah, from 41 different countries, yes.
As you look back at the whole experience of interviewing all these people and writing the book, what's the takeaway for you? What did you learn from writing this?
What did I learn from writing this book? I think the big thing is that despite everyone's differences, this book illustrates that people around the world are fundamentally the same, no matter where you come from, no matter where you were raised, regardless of religion, customs, or other beliefs. In general, we share the same emotions, stresses, and joys. You know, we all want to do well. We want to live, laugh, and love, and it's part of being human. I think that's the biggest theme that came across.
I'm eager to hear about a few of the restaurant owners you profiled here. So let's talk about a couple of those. Is there one that comes to mind first?
Definitely. The opening chapter of the book is about a Nepalese man, and he comes from a small village in the mountains of Nepal. He walked 2 hours each way to go to school, no shoes. He grew up sleeping with the baby goats because tigers would sometimes come into their village and threaten the safety of his family. Mm. And I just think how incredible it is to see that he came from almost nothing, you know, illiterate parents, and now he owns his own business in Amsterdam.
Upward mobility, I guess.
Yes.
Tell me, you got more about him?
Another person that comes to mind is that a famous drummer, he's from Switzerland, but then he started a Swiss fondue restaurant with his uncle, who used to be a nuclear physicist. And I think that combination is rather unique. It's not something you come across. How does a nuclear physicist and drummer come together to open a restaurant in Amsterdam?
No, that is kind of an unlikely pairing there. I'm speaking with Jessica Lipowski. Jessica's the author of the book Flavors of Life and a graduate of MSU's Journalism School. Did you always plan to move to Amsterdam?
Well, I knew I wanted to move overseas. The first time I went to London with my parents, I was 12 years old, and I told my mom, I want to move abroad one day. And in my next trip to Europe, I said the same thing over and over again. I just always knew I wanted to move to Europe. And before I moved, though, in 2011, I was between Amsterdam and London, what I deemed the most English-speaking. And then one thing led to another. In the process, I met my partner who was Dutch, and it became Amsterdam only. So I went for adventure.
Was there some place that was a close second?
Well, London was the close second. But
okay.
I think when I visited Amsterdam for the first time in 2010, just after graduating from Michigan State, I just fell in love with the city. And it clicked. It clicked.
Understood. Understood. It's a wonderful country. What do you enjoy most about living there?
I think my favorite thing about living in Amsterdam is biking everywhere. The biking culture is enormous. I think there's actually more bikes than residents in the city of Amsterdam. It makes it so easy to get around. You can bike from one end of the city to the other in 30 minutes or less. And it's just so convenient and healthy.
I've biked in Holland as well. It's also very conveniently quite flat.
It is quite flat, especially when you compare it to where we live in Michigan.
Did anything surprise you about Amsterdam?
Well, I think the thing that surprised me the most is how diverse it is. I don't think I ever realized that it was home to that many different nationalities, 180 nationalities from around the world. Otherwise, what surprised me is just how open and welcoming people are.
Has living abroad been what you'd hoped? Was it easier? Was it more difficult? Was it about what you expected? Where does it fall on that spectrum?
I think it was what I expected, but I did not expect how long it would take to adjust. I think moving there, you find yourself alone in this foreign land, you don't speak the language, you have no friends, and you have to find your place, just like moving anywhere else, whether you move to the next town over, the next state over, or another country overseas.
How long have you been in Amsterdam then now, Jessica?
It'll be 6 years in February.
Does it still feel at all new, or have you acclimated to the point where you feel like you're a resident there, and it doesn't feel new anymore?
I definitely feel like a resident. However, I discover something new every day. If I'm biking around the city, I take a moment to stop and appreciate the architecture. And I think that comes from moving overseas. You appreciate your new home. You want to take in every single moment, and you want to appreciate every single detail that's going on around you.
You're coming back to MSU to speak to students this week. What do you plan to share with them?
Well, I'm speaking with some journalism students, and I plan to share with them life after MSU, a little bit about creating the book, living as an expat, touching on a little bit about what the election looks like to the expat community abroad, and just hoping to give back to the community, inspire future students.
I can't let a comment like that go unresponded to. What does the election look like to to people in Amsterdam?
Well, I think to leave it at that, the whole world is watching, and I can only speak from my limited perspective living in the Netherlands, so I cannot speak from their perception elsewhere, but the world definitely looks up to the U.S., and everyone is on the edge of their seat on what will happen next and who will win.
You don't think what?
Oh, I cannot understand how we have these two candidates running for office. So I think most people are just curious to see where the election will take us, as I'm sure we all are here in the U.S. as well.
How are you going to vigorously encourage students to experience living abroad like you're doing?
I want to encourage people to travel. I think whether it's traveling, doing a study abroad, or living abroad for a short time, I think it's great to expose yourself to these new and different perspectives. The people I've met just from this book, from my past work experience, the people you meet by happenstance, I think it's really opened my eyes, and I encourage everyone to take the time to travel, even if it's just exploring your own backyard and talking to the person sitting next to you at the coffee house.
What have you missed most about Michigan?
My family. It's definitely difficult to live so far away from my family.
But it's a great excuse for them to fly to Europe.
That it is.
They probably appreciate that, I imagine. You've covered Amsterdam for USA Today as a local expert, and you're also the permanent host of two travel Twitter chats. Tell us about these Twitter chats and how they work, briefly, please.
Of course. So a Twitter chat is basically where people can log into Twitter, and they come together from all around the world, and we talk about a particular topic using a certain hashtag to follow the conversation. One of the chats is called TRLT, which stands for The Road Less Traveled, and the other is Culture Trav, where we discuss all things culture and travel related. Through these chats, I've connected with people from all over the world, both in person and online.
Well, we want to thank our guest. I've been speaking with Jessica Lipowski, an MSU alum and author of the book Flavors of Life. You can keep up with what she's doing by following her on Twitter. That's at @JLipowski. Jessica, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up on Current State, five in a row, somebody make it go away. MSU fell to Maryland last Saturday. Is the dream of a BCS slot slipping away? Well, we've got the Lions, at least, and the Cubbies are headed to the World Series. Current sports host Al Martin brings us up to date. That's later this hour on Current State. Michigan State's Christmas tree is set to be felled this Thursday. The nearly 50-foot blue spruce will be displayed in front of the state capitol, closer to Capitol Avenue than in the past, according to reports. Right now, the tree is enjoying its last few days about 2 miles south of the Sioux Locks in near Sault Ste. Marie. The tree will be lit at Silver Bells in the city in 25 days. It's Current State here on WKAR. The latest data about sexual assault and harassment at Michigan State University were released a few weeks ago. The university's Office of Institutional Equity says that between August of last year and August of this year, officials received 461 complaints that might have violated the school's relationship violence and sexual misconduct policy. MSU says it was the first such compilation of its kind. Here to help us understand the report and put the numbers into some context are two key figures involved in addressing these issues here at MSU. Jessica Norris is Michigan State's Title IX coordinator. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also, we welcome back Andy Durojaye, the director of MSU's recently launched Office of Institutional Equity. Hello again.
Hey, good morning.
Before we put these numbers into some context, remind our listeners what led to this report. This is really part of the university's response to the federal investigation after it was determined MSU was not responding adequately to allegations of sexual harassment and violence, which dates back a few years. Am I correct about that? What more can you flesh that out for us, Jessica?
Sure. Well, the report actually is a first of its kind in the format that was released, but under the Office for Inclusion, MSU had been providing similar data for several years. So we took a new approach to it this year and tried to provide information in a format that was easily accessible to the campus community. But the information provided was really in response to requests from the campus community for more information and more transparency rather than a requirement.
Okay.
Coming from OCR.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Andy Durojaye, what's the mission of the Office of Institutional Equity?
So the mission of the office is to facilitate or foster a campus that's free of all forms of discrimination and harassment. Going with our themes of inclusiveness here at the university, we try to make sure that, you know, all individuals don't have situations where they're subject to, you know, to different treatment or hostile environments based on protected class participation. And so that covers a host of areas, but as well sexual harassment, sexual assault, and relationship violence.
It's probably worth at least just briefly revisiting the significance of Title IX here as well, concisely if possible. Jessica, what is Title IX? What does it mean for schools like MSU? Sure.
Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 prohibits sex discrimination in any programs, education programs, or activities receiving federal financial assistance.
Well, let's put some key numbers in some kind of context here. From mid-August last year to mid-August this year, 461 incidents reported under the school's relationship violence and sexual misconduct policy. Those could involve sexual harassment, sexual assault, relationship violence, and stalking. 461 is quite a bit higher than the previous number, correct, Jessica?
That is correct.
What significance do you attach to that number?
I think the increase is a result of efforts at MSU to increase awareness around this important topic and to encourage reporting to the new Office of Institutional Equity.
Clarify for us, though, these were calls from complainants alleging they were harassed, stalked, or assaulted, correct?
It could be complaints coming directly from an individual. It could be incidents reported to the police department where then the claimant asked to have a university investigation as well, or they could be reports coming through our mandatory reporters, which are MSU employees.
Well, help us understand a few other key numbers here. Of the 461 complaints received, 66 triggered formal investigations, and 38 confirmed violations. Let's unpack that a little bit. First, which complaints lead to formal investigations and which don't?
Sure. Well, certainly we provided some statistics in the report where we talked about cases that were investigated versus those that were not. In cases where investigations were not undertaken, they were cases where we didn't have participation from the claimant, didn't have sufficient information to proceed. There are also cases where the university may not have jurisdiction to investigate in some cases as well.
That's quite a few cases, though, where people just simply didn't step forward and supply more information. What do you take from that?
Well, these are complex issues. And so, you know, as we look at mandatory reporting, you know, those reports may come in through an employee or a staff member who is seeking to provide resources and support to students. But in the end, a student or an employee may not wish to participate in an investigation, but may wish to utilize the support resources that are available on campus.
And the 66 formal investigations resulted in 38 confirmed violations. Did any patterns emerge from the confirmed violations?
Well, I think when you look at the report overall, one pattern that we noted is as you look at on-campus incidents broadly, not just violations, that, you know, most of our incidents on campus are occurring within our residence halls. And so certainly that's something that we look at those patterns and opportunities to determine our training interventions and our programming and awareness events. And so certainly OIE has increased the number of training programs and educational events that we're providing to students and staff in the residence halls and more broadly across campus.
Andy Durajaye, what was the impact of having these numbers in front of you here recently? When they first arrived, what did you make of them? What do you make of them?
Well, I think Jessica alluded to it perfectly. The fact that we've got raised awareness, what we're doing here, we're having a concerted effort to make sure that we train all of our partners on campus. So mandatory reporting is being done via electronic training, but also via in-person training. We're meeting with all of our RAs multiple times a year. We're meeting with, you know, different employees on campus multiple times a year. We've met with all academic staff from deans all the way down to, you know, our different professors. And so we've done a concerted effort to make sure we kind of paint the campus so everybody's aware of OI and aware of what we do. And so we knew that with that being said, we were going to see more reports. You know, when we talk about the formal investigations and that 66 number, you know, I think that's in line with national trends regarding the numbers of investigations that are happening at an institution of our size. So, you know, I'm not surprised by that numbers. I think going forward, because the office is new and as people gain more confidence in the office and in the process, we'll continue to see these type of numbers.
Andy Durajaye is the director of MSU's Office of Institutional Equity. Jessica Norris also joins me today. She is Michigan State's Title IX coordinator. We're talking about the latest data about sexual assault and harassment here at Michigan State University. This report is the first of its kind. Are there changes or refinements you're making to this process now that you're into the second year?
Absolutely. So we actually review our policy and procedures annually to ensure that we are not only meeting our compliance obligations, but meeting the needs of the campus community. So one of the biggest or most substantive changes we made heading into the 2016-17 academic year was that we refined and streamlined the student conduct and appeal process. And the changes that we made to that process, we believe, will increase the speed with which that process is executed while continuing to preserve fairness.
66 formal investigations, Andy. Talk to us a little bit about what goes into a formal investigation.
So a formal investigation, as you mentioned, those 461 reports we got initially. And so whenever we get a report, it's our job in the Office of Institutional Equity to reach out to the individuals mentioned in that report. So we would reach out to a claimant to explain who we are, offer our assistance, and let them know what we do from a function in the university. Once we've done that, once we've had a chance to meet with them, we give them the option of sitting down and talking with us and letting them know if we want to go forward. At that point, if they want to go forward with a formal investigation and we feel we have enough information to move forward a formal investigation, that would trigger the entire investigative process. And so that's what takes it from an initial report to a formal report. Jessica alluded to, but whenever we get a complaint under our RVSM policy, we always treat it as formal, but it doesn't always trigger a full-scale investigation. Okay. We make sure that we're responding the same way to every single report, but the formal investigation is going to be something that happens after we've received that preliminary information and we think we have enough to go forward with.
Still, 66 formal investigations had to be conducted. How many people do we have at MSU doing this work?
So right now, currently, we have 7 investigators in the office working. We also have Jessica and myself. And so it is a lot of work. I think that we made a smart move of hiring the investigators that we have, and we continue to add to the office. So I think that right now we are in a good place as far as having enough people to handle the information. But it is one of those things that we're going to have to continue to assess on an annual basis as well.
And Jessica, you alluded to this earlier. Help us understand, when someone is found to have violated the policy and it's serious, it's a sexual assault, let's say, how, if at all, do the police or the county prosecutor get involved?
Well, our process here at MSU is entirely separate from any criminal investigation or prosecution that may occur. So when we have a claimant, they have the right to engage both in a university investigation process and a criminal investigation process simultaneously or at different times if they wish. So the outcome of an OIE investigation, if we're talking about a student respondent, would be disciplinary action through the Student Conduct Office at MSU. And if a claimant desired to have a criminal investigation as well, those two can be occurring at the same time, but MSU has no influence or bearing over a criminal investigation or prosecution.
You mentioned efforts at streamlining the appeals process. Are you seeing the appeals process tighten as a result of the efforts you've already made, or is most of the progress still in the future?
Well, we just implemented those changes with the beginning of the academic year, and so we haven't had many cases proceed through that process, but so far, you know, we are seeing that the timelines and the process has been pared down the way we expect. However, we'll be working closely with our partners in student affairs as well as student governance to assess how well it's working and make adjustments as necessary going forward.
Andy, these investigations have taken longer and in some cases much longer to investigate than even the university policies allowed. A story by Michigan Radio late last year told of an investigation that took 8 months that, according to the guidelines at the time, should have been wrapped in 90 days. Are they still taking too long to investigate and resolve?
So I don't think they're taking too long. You know, when you're dealing with people in situations like this, any time it's going to seem like a long amount of time. But I think under our current policy, under our current practice, we've done a good job in streamlining the process. As you referenced that 8-month-long investigation, in the last year, we have not had any investigations that have come anywhere near that long. And if we do have situations now under our new policy where we are going to take longer than our allotted 60 days, we make sure we notify the parties to give them an opportunity to, you know, respond and understand what it is we're doing and why we're taking a little bit longer than we planned to initially.
How quickly can you wrap up a formal, how quickly can you start and then finish a formal investigation?
Well, the goal is 60 days. And so, again, it always is going to depend on the nature of the allegations, the nature of the complaint. You know, some complaints are involving two individuals and we don't have any witnesses. And so those situations, we can wrap them up rather quickly. But some situations involve, you know, a lot of volume of material we have to review, a lot of witnesses that we have to interview. And because of that, it could lead to an extended time during the investigation process. So, again, we shoot for 60 days all the time, but it's going to be case by case.
There's lots of questions that I'd like to ask you. We don't have time for all of them. If you could change one feature of this broader landscape here, Jessica, what would you change?
Well, I think there's a lot of room for cultural change, not just at MSU, but in the broader community and national context. This is an issue that all universities, and now we're even seeing a lot of high schools, are wrestling with. And so, you know, any opportunities we have to, you know, promote change in this area, I think will positively benefit us all.
How confident are you that all these efforts will make the campus safer? Andy?
I think that the efforts we're taking, the efforts around awareness, I think are going to make the campus safer. But again, I always caution when I tell people that is, you know, what Jessica and I do is in response to situations. And we, you know, we affect the climate, but we are not on the front end. So that's one of the big things that we have to work here at MSU and across the nation. How do we attack this issue on the front end so that it doesn't come to the point where OIE or offices like OIE are having to do investigations?
And but the goal would seem to be, how do you turn 38 confirmed violations into fewer and fewer every year. Mm-hmm. Has the federal government responded to the report in any way?
No.
Okay.
No.
No, nothing. Okay. We want to thank both of our guests. Jessica Norris is Michigan State's Title IX coordinator. Andy Durajaye is the director of MSU's recently launched Office of Institutional Equity. We're talking about the latest data about sexual assault and harassment at Michigan State, released just a few weeks ago. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
There is precious little to cheer about this season for fans of Michigan State football, now losers of five straight after laying an egg against Maryland on Saturday. They're off to their worst Big Ten start since Muddy Waters was coaching the program. The Spartans will try to climb out of the mud this weekend when they host rival Michigan, who is ranked number two in the country. Current sports host Al Martin joins us now to talk Spartans, Wolverines, and the Lions, who look pretty good this year after another victory. Welcome back, Al.
How you doing, Mark? Yeah, how about the Lions, right?
Yeah, how about that?
We'll get to them, yeah.
It was kind of a classic ending, but it turned out well. How would you classify the struggle for this year's MSU football team? I mean, is this a coaching or a player personnel problem? What?
Well, I think that, as Mark D'Antonio has said all year, Mark, this is an all-inclusive problem. It is both the players and the coaches. And if you look at what's occurred this year, Mark, I mean, just to focus on an aspect here, this team is very young. Now, granted, very young and talented, but at the same time, very young. And if you just look at the defensive side of the football against Maryland on Saturday, Michigan State played six true freshmen. And we saw what happened in the first quarter. Riley Bulla, a leader of this team, one of the three captains for Michigan State, he finally gets in to start a game, right? Because he hasn't been healthy all this year. He has three personal foul penalties. The last personal foul penalty is a targeting penalty.
Yeah.
He gets ejected in the game. Then you have to burn another red shirt in Joe Bocci, who comes in and has to replace your leader in Riley Bulla. Tall order for him. I thought for the most part, though, Joe did a good job of holding down the fort. But when you have six true freshmen playing defense for Michigan State, I mean, it's a bit tough to try and tread water and expect a lot out of them. Tyler O'Connor, he was supposed to start at quarterback, and I think it's pretty clear now that he is the best out of the three quarterbacks that we've seen this year for Michigan State. He can't play because of an ankle injury. So you have, again, that youth thing, right? Brian Lewerke has to come in and try to salvage that game. And, you know, you're going to have growing pains anytime you have a young quarterback. There was one play, if you remember in that game, Mark, where he clearly had Donnie Corley on a slant route. He throws it at Donnie's feet. If Donnie catches that football, nothing but grass in front of him. That's a touchdown. That's a touchdown that you're missing out on. So those are the growing pains that you deal with when having a young quarterback. And then I talk about the coaching problem for Michigan State. Michigan State going for it and trying a fake field goal so early in that game, right before the first half, that, Mark, was a sign of desperation. And I think that if you go back and you ask Mark D'Antonio if he would have changed his mind on that play, I think he would have. That just shows you, though, that they're in such a rye right now that they're trying anything to try and jumpstart this team, even a fake field goal early on in the first half.
What are the chances the Spartans make a bowl game, in your estimation?
Very slim right now, Mark. Very slim. I mean, you look at the schedule moving forward. Of course, you have Michigan coming to town this Saturday, right? They go on the road to play Illinois after that. They have back-to-back home games against Rutgers and Ohio State after that, and then they end the year at Penn State, a team that just upset Ohio State.
How about that?
Crazy, right? So, I mean, if you look at it, and speaking logically here, looking at the rest of the schedule, it's unfair to think Michigan State is going to beat Michigan right now. I mean, right now, Vegas opened up the line, and Michigan State is a 3-touchdown underdog, 21-point underdog this weekend, right? They're not going to win that, in my estimation. Ohio State, that's a tall order. They're not going to win that. They have to beat Illinois and Rutgers, and you still need one more game to become bowl eligible. And to beat Penn State on the road, that's tough to go to Happy Valley and have to do that. So right now, if you have to ask me, Mark, I would say no.
The Monday of Michigan week, is there any – I mean, Michigan just looks so strong. Is there any exploitable weakness in this team?
Well, that's the question. It's very hard to pick one, right? Wilton Spate is getting better week after week after week. Right now, the defense is leading the nation in scoring defense, only allowing a little over 10 points per game. In four Big Ten games, they've held opponents to just a combined 25 points. If there is a weakness, Mark, if there is any hope for Michigan State this weekend, make Wilton Spate beat you. Make him, because we haven't seen Wilton Spate, you know, with his back against the wall, a lot of pressure on him to have to go out and make big play after big play. Try and contain the running game and make his arm beat you. That's the only way I see Michigan State even having a chance this weekend.
How does the Penn State-Ohio State upset impact the Big Ten picture?
Well, even though that was a huge upset, right? I mean, we saw everybody in Happy Valley, the Penn State fans at least, storm the field. I mean, a big win, right?
Stunner.
But,
a
you know,
stunner.
I kind of equate it to what happened to Michigan State last year against Nebraska. You know, even though big game, huge upset, Ohio State can still book a ticket to the Big Ten championship game if they can beat Michigan. So the goals for Ohio State are still right in front of them. I don't want anybody to panic here just because Ohio State moved down to 6 in the AP poll. If they can still beat Michigan later on this year, they will have a chance at the college football playoff.
Let's switch gears to the Lions here, because this is pretty encouraging. Just when it looked like former MSU quarterback Kirk Cousins was going to lead the Washington Redskins to a win. I mean, this so much happened in the last couple of minutes. Matthew Stafford put on the Superman cape. How have the Lions been able to overcome one of the hottest teams in the league?
Well, I think the biggest and easiest answers has been Matthew Stafford. I mean, Matthew Stafford is playing arguably right now the best football out of any quarterback in the league right now. I mean, it's really tough to sort of pinpoint what has led to Matthew Stafford really just emerging this year and becoming one of the elite quarterbacks in this season. But we've seen 3 straight weeks now in this 3-game winning streak in which he has led his team down the field for a game-winning drive with under a minute left. 24, I should say, game-winning drives for him when you take into account what took place yesterday against the Redskins. And I think that this is kind of a blessing in disguise. Calvin Johnson not being there this year, it forced us to really see what Matthew Stafford can do, because he's not honing in on one target. They became very predictable when Calvin Johnson, one of the best wide receivers in the league, was with the team, because they would just hone in on him. Now, when he's forced to spread the football around and hit other targets, he's showing the entire repertoire right now. And I also want to shout out the Lions defense, who made some big key stops in that game as well, Mark.
A quick update on Mid-Michigan High School football. How many of our local teams made the playoffs?
How about this? 21 Lansing area teams. Very cool stuff. That includes, because, you know, when it comes to high school football, the magic number is 6 as well, Mark. So you got to get at least 6 wins to guarantee a spot in the playoffs. There were 3 5-4 teams, though, that when the committee, you know, were making their decision, they decided that these teams had some big enough wins to at least make it to the dance as well. Williamston, Olivet, and Stockbridge, all at 5-4, also made the playoffs, Mark. Very happy for East Lansing. They are back in the playoffs for the first time in 4 years. And Sexton and Williamston, who I just mentioned, they are in the playoffs for the first time in 2 years. So Lansing-Sexton holding the flag right now for the Lansing area team.
And we've got an all Midwest World Series.
Oh, how crazy is
Why
that?
Why do right? I love that theme. I love the idea of Cleveland fans driving to Chicago and Chicago fans. I mean, they you know, yeah. You can drive it. You don't have to fly it necessarily.
Yeah. You don't. Yeah, I'm wondering if they'll take a bus to those games, right? Probably not, but still, that's kind of funny to think about. How cool is that, though, right? I mean, you have two of the most deprived franchises in baseball history. 68 years for Cleveland, 107 for the Cubs, now meeting in the World Series. I think it's safe to say, Mark, whoever wins out of this whole thing, hey, no matter what, somebody's winning, okay? I think everybody wins in a game of baseball when you see both of these franchises go at it.
Both deprived. To be sure. I think the Cubs have picked up even more national fans probably in this process.
Yes,
though,
certainly.
I hope they can make it happen. Al Martin, host of Current Sports here on WKAR. Catch the program with lots more. 1 o'clock this afternoon on AM 870. Thank you, Al.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Anytime.
Have a great day. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, our election 2016 coverage continues with a look at election day preparations in mid-Michigan. We could see record turnout at the polls 2 weeks from tomorrow. In some cases, officials have had to order more ballots to meet the forecast demand. We'll talk with Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram and Lansing City Clerk Chris Swope about precincts, predictions, and protection. And Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson joins us for a chat about October's environmental stories in our Great Lakes Month in Review. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Peter Worf's our executive producer. Thanks to Kevin Lavery, who directed today. Also, Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. Have a great day. Current State on WKAR.